for them in order to agree that the United Nations peace negotiations are probably the only way to stop this conflict without either party having to be completely defeated in the field. If you want to stop the conflict and prevent further bloodshed and prevent the drawing out of this war for years to come, then you need to negotiate.
The ongoing conflict in Yemen shows no sign of abating, with more civilians being killed and displaced every day. In the meantime, the United States' moves on Yemen have not only damaged the horizons for peace, but also hamper efforts to provide much-needed aid to millions of people.
On Friday, the news agency Reuters published a report on a confidential letter sent by Iran to the International Atomic Energy Agency on Iran. The letter contained information on Iran's safeguard measures in its nuclear enrichment plant in the central city of Natanz. The leak prompted an angry reaction from Iran and other countries. Iran condemned the IAEA and criticized the leak. Iran's permanent envoy to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, said that the agency is responsible for the incident and that the agency's confidentiality mechanisms are seriously flawed. He said that Iran will shortly take legal action over the leak of information. Gharibabadi stressed that reporting confidential information without following the declassification procedure is illegal.
All safeguards and JCPOA reports, as well as Iran's correspondence with the IAEA and vice versa, are confidential. The IAEA shares its reports in its internal site, only accessible to its member states.
Gharibabadi said that Tehran has already asked the agency to minimize the amount of details it gives its member states in its reports and to avoid providing them with non-essential information. He said the history of Iran's legal protests against the IAEA over its failure to preserve confidential information dates back more than two decades.
In 2018, the Washington Post reported that Israeli intelligence agencies and experts have been have gotten a hold, actually, of sensitive information of Iran's nuclear capability through the IAEA. And this is no accident, given that the IAEA is heavily biased towards Israel. So it's natural that the spies involved have had institutional leverage as well with officials that were working with the IAEA and using it as an opportunity to extract information about Iran's nuclear capabilities.
Indeed, the incident is the latest in a series of tensions between Iran and the IAEA over the matter. This is not the first time that confidential information on Iran is leaked by the Atomic Agency. Over the years, and even before signing the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, confidential information related to Iran has been leaked to non-parties to the JCPOA on many occasions. After signing the deal, Iran witnessed leakage of its confidential reports and information by the UN nuclear watchdog numerous times. With the ongoing tension between Iran and the UN nuclear agency, it may be safe to say that the trust between Iran and the IAEA is at its lowest level. Observers say that the IAEA-Iran cooperation problems and lack of trust between them comes from a series of issues. The main reason can be that the UN nuclear watchdog's unprofessional behavior in conducting inspections in Iran. Tehran says on numerous occasions the agency's request was based on unfounded documents or baseless allegations. There were also incidents that fueled the distrust. One of the most significant cases was an IAEA inspector who tried to contaminate the Iranian nuclear facilities with nuclear materials of an unknown origin. Another case was the explosion that occurred at the Natanz nuclear facility. Iran says the only official party that has the details of the activities at Natanz was the IAEA. Observers say incidents like these are the source of distrust between Iran and the agency. No wonder Iran hesitates to allow certain inspections on its nuclear facilities. There are also serious allegations that indicate IAEA's mismanagement to protect Tehran's confidential information, which has led to the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists over the years. U.S. political influence on the IAEA is another reason. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the deal in 2018 and imposed the toughest ever sanctions under its so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Experts say now the U.S. is trying to turn the nuclear agency into part of their pressure campaign. They say the U.S. has always exploited international institutions to implement their policies against certain countries when they fail to directly pressure those countries.
There's no doubt about it. The IAEA is serving as a direct intelligence arm between Israel, the European Union, and the United States as an agency that has consistently demonstrated its bias and preferential treatment in favor of Israel, who have consistently used the agency to lobby for harsher aggression and action against Iran. In favor, obviously, of Israel, who at the same time is not a signatory on the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, and has weapons stockpiles, nuclear stockpiles of its own that it does not allow any inspection of by international agencies.
Iran has always expressed readiness to further cooperate with the IAEA in a bid to reach an understanding on the unresolved issues. It also announced that it had full cooperation with the UN nuclear agency. However, the recent incident shows that the IAEA once again has failed to build trust with Iran, which raises the question as to why Tehran should continue trusting the agency with its confidential information.
It seems that there's finally a light at the end of the tunnel when it comes to the development and administration of a vaccine against the COVID-19 virus, with multiple research centres finally in the latter stages of producing a viable and effective vaccine against the virus. However, while so close to the end, is the decision by the British to roll out the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine a little too soon. Already the British and the US have been arguing about the timing of the promise by the British government to start inoculating the most vulnerable groups of people in the UK by as early as this coming Monday, with the US criticising the British either due to the early release of a yet untested product, or maybe through jealousy of being pipped to the post by the Brits. With the UK having the worst rates in Europe, with already 60,000 people dead from the virus, the US is also in a difficult situation, with around 1,500 people dying each day, and already 276,000 people having succumbed to the coronavirus in America. Embarrassing figures for the outgoing President of the United States, who would have no doubt enjoyed being the first to distribute the vaccine. So why then are the British and Americans fighting over the issue? With the British choosing to start with the order of 40 million Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines, it seems odd that they have chosen a vaccine developed outside of the UK. Yet when one examines the effectiveness of the vaccines available, the British version, developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, is only around 62% effective. Hence maybe why the British have rushed ahead with the German-US version, quicker than the Americans and the Germans themselves. So could the tension then come from the attitude of the British when it comes to wanting to get the vaccine out as quickly as possible, rushing it through the regulators at such a pace? British Education Minister Gavin Williamson clearly flared tempers with his attitude towards the US and the EU when he stated that British regulators were obviously better, and then going one step further, saying the whole of the UK was better than the US and the EU. Clearly a diplomatic flop by publicly stating such words. What now remains to be seen is A, just how realistic the monumental task of distributing a vaccine that needs to be kept at minus 70 degrees will be, and B, will the US show any sympathy towards the UK should the process fail, and as Britain comes crashing out of the EU, looking at the US for a future trade deal. Britain is against the ropes when it comes to the Brexit negotiations with the EU. However, the announcement that the British will have the vaccine out on Monday is something that the British negotiating team will secretly be proud of as talks reach a stalemate in London. But the EU, with all its red tape, bureaucracy and processes, has yet to fully approve any developed vaccine so far and has taken the opportunity to criticise the UK for a hasty decision when it comes to announcing the vaccine will be available to various groups within Britain. Until the European Medicines Agency approves the vaccine, the rest of the continent will have to remain patient. However, There are arguments that the EMA is more rigorous than the British, leading the Germans to label the move by the British as problematic. But the UK may have one valid point when it comes to the rollout. If the vaccine is truly over 95% effective and it can save lives, then what's wrong with the British taking such a step? With the British finding themselves stuck in a desperate situation when it comes to agreeing a deal with the EU in the post-Brexit era, and time fast running out before the deadline approaches to switch to WTO rules, could then the decision by the British to start distribution be a final dig at the EU and prove that by no longer being part of the bloc, it can take such decisions without fallout that would have emerged from Brussels should they still have been members? But the truth of the matter is simple. This is one of the world's worst cases of a global pandemic, at least in modern times, and the economic impact, as well as the devastating cost of life, has left a scar and legacy that will never be forgotten. So whether it be Pfizer-BioNTech, AstraZeneca, Moderna, or Gamaleya, and whether it's the UK, the US, or the EU, or in fact any other country that starts the vaccine first, at the end of the day, this is a humanitarian issue, and when the time comes, the whole world will need the doses eventually.
Millions of American people are headed for absolute disaster, one observer said on Monday, December 7th, as Moody's Analytics reported that 12 million renters are expected to owe an average of $5,850 in back rents and utilities after the new year. According to the Washington Post, many American landlords have begun filing paperwork to evict struggling tenants already, and others have joined renters in appealing to Congress for significant unemployment benefits and another round of $1,200 direct payments to Americans. Dear listeners, in this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading Millions of American Tenants Headed for Absolute Disaster After New Year, Owing Average of Nearly $6,000 in Rent and Utilities. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Without a coronavirus relief package centered on helping U.S. working families who have lost jobs and watched their savings dwindle amid the pandemic, millions of American people are headed for absolute disaster, one observer said on Monday, December 7th, as Moody's Analytics reported that 12 million renters are expected to owe an average of $5,850 in back rent and utilities after the new year. The financial firm reported that $70 billion could be owed to landlords in January after a federal moratorium on evictions put in place in September by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In the absence of any action from the Republican-led Senate aimed at helping working people, expires on December 31st. According to the Washington Post, many American landlords have begun filing paperwork to evict struggling tenants already, and others have joined renters in appealing to Congress for significant unemployment benefits and another round of $1,200 direct payments to Americans. Separately from Moody's, the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia reported in October that 1.3 million households that have faced unemployment during the pandemic owed an average of $5,400 in back payments to landlords and utilities. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 29% of black renters and 17% of Latino renters are behind in payments, and 21% of families with children have been pushed into debt. Some families have been forced to begin selling their belongings since the Republican-led Senate allowed weekly unemployment benefits of $600 expire in July, according to the Post. U.S. lawmakers on Monday, December 7th, were negotiating a new aid package after a bipartisan group of senators introduced a $908 billion bill last week. According to Post reporter Jeff Stein, the package currently includes a $300 weekly payment, which would be offered only from January to April, with no retroactive payments to help families who owe rent and other payments from recent months. The package includes $25 billion for rental housing assistance, far less than what's expected to be owed by families in January, and only half of what the House Democrats' HEROES Act includes for low-income renters, and a proposal by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell did not include anything for struggling renters. This is like a Charles Dickens novel. Mark Wolf, executive director of the National Energy Assistance Directors Association, told the Post. It's an evolving story of how people at the bottom are suffering. Diane Yentel, president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, called on U.S. Congress to extend the current eviction moratorium and provide rent relief to struggling households. Former Labor Secretary Robert Reich highlighted the reports of struggling renters as the latest evidence that Georgia voters must elect two Democrats, Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff, in the runoff election scheduled for January 5th, to give the U.S. any hope of having a Senate which will help working families in the coming year.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Light of Allah, you are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, Assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from series of The Last Savior from IRB English Radio. If you have been following this series of shows, we have been talking about the hadith and narrations around the topic of the last savior, and specifically the reason that the dreams can be looked at as a proof for the ordinary people about the authority of dreams, and if we are allowed to take the dreams as the proof for us to act upon them in our daily lives based on the beliefs that we have. And actually main topic is the authority of dream for some people to claim that they are Mahdi of the time, or they actually tell us some news about the arrival of the Imam of the age, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. Whether they can be trusted or not, we have said that these sort of dreams cannot be trusted, because the dreams need to be sadaqah, to be true dreams. And the real interpreters of the dreams are the infallible imams, and it has some conditions for these dreams to be interpreted. Though some people among the believers, there are some people who can understand and actually interpret these dreams, but there are very few. Sheikh Murtada Karimi from Qom Seminary Schools. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation. So Sheikh, please elaborate on this point, that what is it going to happen when we dream the Holy Prophet, and some come to us and tell us that they have dreamed the infallible Imam, but the information that is being transferred and is given to us is not something that can be issued by a Prophet or Imam. But how can we actually digest these things, Sheikh, and actually collect between these information?
I think this is the most important discussion in our series of discussions about the dreams. People claim that we have seen the infallibles, the prophet, the imams, and they have told us that, for example, you have to follow this claimant, which is, in our view, a false claimant. And according to some narration that you mentioned, Satan cannot be in the format of the prophet and the imam, and the imams even in the dreams, which inshallah we'll discuss about these narrations in details. So they come to this conclusion that, okay, in the dream I was told that this is the prophet talking to you, and he told me that you have to follow this claimant. Mm-hmm. This is not a new issue. This is the first point. I mean, it has been discussed by many scholars during the history of Islam and Shia school of thought. Sheikh Mufid, who passed away in 413, he has talked about the validity of the infallible prophet or imam's statement in the dreams. Sayyid al-Murtada, Allama Karajaki, Allama Hili, and so on and so forth. First of all, we can think of different ways. I mean, the types of the dreams that people see are very different. We have to, put them in different categories. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, because the point is that people come to us and claim that I have seen the prophet.
True.
Now, the question is that how you were made sure that this is the prophet talking to you. Us living in the time of the major occultician, we have not seen the prophet.
True.
And many of the narrations which talk about seeing the prophet and the imams in the dreams and the authority of such dreams, they exactly refer to the dream of the person who lived at the time of the prophet or the imams. And then he or she saw them in the dreams. So when a person comes to us and says that I saw the prophet, the first question is that how are you sure that he was the prophet?
Suppose that the prophet himself in the dream told him that this is the prophet you're talking
about. That's the point. Because of that, we have different categories.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the first one is that sometimes a person has seen the prophet or the imam, like those people who lived at their time, and then he sees the same person in the dreams.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first one. Second of all, we are talking about the time of the major occultician. We have not seen any face of the infallibles in our time. In the dream, I just feel that this is the prophet. It happens a lot to the people. I mean, even that person, he doesn't tell them that I'm the prophet, I'm Imam Mahdi, I'm this infallible imam. That person just feels that this is the prophet or the imam. The third one is that, as you mentioned, that very person in the dream, he tells this person that I am the prophet or the imam. In another case, the person just guesses that he was the Prophet or the Imam, or she was Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha, because of some evidences. For example, you know that in the books of supplication, we have some a'mal, some deeds to be done, some supplications to be said in order for people to see the infallibles. So a person has done some deeds and some supplications, and then he or she see a dream, and then they guess because of these evidences that this is the infallible imam. So these are different categories, and we have to discuss in its own part. Now, for those people who lived at the time of the imams and the prophets, they can make sure that the person they saw was really the prophet and the imam. For them, there is no doubt.
True.
And many of the narrations which talk about seeing the prophet and the imams in the dreams and the authority of such dreams, they exactly refer to this type of dreams. The dream of the person who lived at the time of the prophet or the imams, and then he or she saw them in the dreams.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes we see in a dream a person that is similar to a painting that we saw from the imam or the prophet while we are awake. It happens a lot. That unfortunately, we see that nowadays some people claim that this image belongs to prophet. There is a famous image which is attributed to Prophet Muhammad when he was youth. Or, for example, to Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, or Imam al-Mahdi, and so on and so forth. Now, in the dream, I see the same image and painting. Is it a true dream? Of course not. I mean, none of these paintings are reliable. I mean, we cannot make sure that in reality this is the face of the Prophet. No one can prove that. So, if in a dream I see a person which is exactly like that painting, I cannot claim that I have seen the Prophet. It is because it's been in my mind, in my brain, in my thoughts that this is the Prophet. I see the same image and painting. But can you make sure that this is the Prophet? Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
This will be more interesting when we pay attention to the fact that according to the narrations, of course, we're not talking about jurisprudence here. According to some narrations, the infallible themselves, they prohibited people from painting the face. So when they have prohibited the people, how then can we refer to the painting to prove that the person that I saw was the prophet or the imam? So if we see a person similar to a painting, we cannot claim that we have seen the prophet. The other case is that sometimes some people, they see in the dream a person that they know in their life,
mm-hmm.
a righteous person. But in the dream, they are told that this is Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, or Imam Mahdi, or Lady Zahra, salamullahi alayha, but the face is similar to one of the people who lives at his time or her
true.
Time. Again, this dream is not a true dream, and they cannot claim that we have seen the infallible, because there is no narration which tells us that in the dream you can see the Prophet or the Imam or Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha in the face of another person.
Mm-hmm.
So those narrations which talk about seeing the Prophet and the Imams in the dreams, they are not talking about seeing them in the face of another person, which we know.
Wherever you be, you're the one, my heart is to meet you.
So still we're talking about the invalidity or lack of authority of dreams for showing us the way, specifically in the leadership of the Islamic Ummah, right?
Yeah. The other category was that sometimes we feel that the person we saw in the dream was Imam Mahdi, was Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. It happens a lot. In the dream, that person does not tell us that I am the Prophet
mm-hmm.
or I am Imam Mahdi. We just feel that he is the Prophet or the Imam. Is it an authentic dream? No. You have to make sure that that person has been the Prophet or Imam Mahdi. Feeling here doesn't have any function. You have to be sure about that. Especially when, for example, we have done a kind of talqeen to ourselves. That, for example, this night I will saw the Prophet or the Imam because of the fact that I have done some recommended deeds and I have recited some supplications. According to the scholars, it is very likely that these dreams are related to our imaginations and thoughts before going to dreams. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about seeing the Prophet tonight. You know, for example, many people, it happens to them that before going to sleep, they think that I'm going to buy a car and a house and so on and so forth. And right the same night, they see in the dream that they have bought the car or the house that they were thinking about just before going to dreams.
True.
So if before going to sleep, I think about that, about seeing the Prophet or Imam Mahdi in the dream or Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha, mm-hmm. It is also likely that it happens to me.
Yeah.
But is it a reality? No. If you just feel that this person is the Prophet or the Imam, it doesn't prove that this is the reality.
Okay.
And now for the followers of this false claimant from Basra, this is very important. Why? Because this false claimant from Basra, Ahmad Ismail, he has a kind of instruction to his followers. For example, he says that you have to fast for 3 days and then do a kind of tawassul to Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha or read a supplication for 40 days, then you will see a dream in which you will be told that I am with the truth. So it is very likely for these people also that they feel that that person in the dream has been the Prophet or Imam Mahdi,
mm-hmm.
because they were thinking about that for 3 days, for 40 days, and then they dream and they just feel that this is the Prophet talking to them.
Very
or
true.
They just feel that this is Imam Mahdi alayhi salam talking to them. When it comes to the main category in which a person sees a dream, and in the dream the Prophet tells him that I am the Prophet, or the Imam Mahdi or another Imam tells him or her that I am the Imam or Lady Zahra Salamullahi Alayha, what about that? So it's different. It's different from feeling or guessing. In this case, they are telling us that they are the Prophet or the Imam.
Mm-hmm. So what is the difference then?
First of all, the first point is again regarding the interpretation of these dreams. The point is that even if we see the Prophet or the Imam, we mention that a lot, that even if you really see the Prophet or the Imam in your dream, how are you going to interpret that dream? We said that it happens a lot that you see something in the dream, but the interpretation is exactly otherwise. There is famous narration regarding this from Ayman. We may see the Prophet in the dream, but the interpretation is not as we think. It can be otherwise.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada, and you respected listeners for your staying tuned. In this session again, we have been talking about the validity and authority of dreams, in showing us the way for the leadership of the Islamic Ummah specifically. We have talked about the true dreams and false dreams, but we said that even in case that there is a true dream, it needs to have a good interpretation, and the interpretation actually can be done through very few believers, that they are not actually that easily accessible, and also the infallibles that we unfortunately are deprived of their presence. The case that we are specifically talking about is the validity and authority of true dreams to tell us who is going to be the Imam of the Islamic society. Actually, we say that it can never ever work for these purposes. So the leadership of the Islamic Ummah is a very vital issue that needs strong proofs to prove the leader of the Islamic Ummah. So it cannot be left to dreams, and whether it's true or false claims and different issues around it, and also the person that we might dream, the person that we have already seen in our dreams, whether this is the infallible Imam or not. These are the stories that actually was discussed a little bit, inshallah, will be talked about in depth in upcoming sessions. But let us again emphasize on this point, dear brothers and sisters, that dreams can never be trusted in such way for appointment of the Islamic leader. Allahumma.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hasan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
In the limelight. The European Union is Britain's biggest trading partner, accounting for 47% of its trade in 2019. It had a trade deficit of £79 billion, or $106 billion, with the European Union, a surplus of £18 billion in services, outweighed by a deficit of £97 billion in goods. Even with a Brexit trade deal, Britain's reasonable worst-case scenario is that 7,000 trucks bound for the continent could stack up in the southern English county of Kent. Britain's Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, has forecast a no-trade deal would wipe an extra 2% off British economic output in 2021, whilst driving up inflation, driving up unemployment and public borrowing. Britain's Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, said tariffs under World Trade Organization rules and border disruptions would hit parts of the economy, such as manufacturing, that were emerging relatively unscathed from the COVID-19 pandemic. The long-term hit could be costly for both Britain and the 27 remaining EU members. Germany, Europe's biggest economy, is Britain's biggest EU trading partner. The shock would be felt unevenly across the continental Europe, with those likely to be hit worst, including Ireland, the Netherlands, Belgium, France, Luxembourg, Malta, and Poland. The Halle Institute for Economic Research has forecast that European Union companies exporting to Britain could lose more than 700,000 jobs if no trade deal is agreed. We have prepared an article for you written jointly by Guy Falconbridge and John Chalmers. The piece is titled, The Potential Impact of Brexit Without a Trade Deal. The article has been taken from the website of the Reuters news agency. Please stay with us for more of Guy Falconbridge and John Chalmers' article. Britain and European Union sought on Sunday, 6th of December, to strike an elusive trade deal, with failure likely to end with trade in chaos, markets tumbling and a huge economic price to pay. Here are some of the potential pressure points of a no-trade deal after 5 years of Brexit crisis. Sterling. According to major foreign exchange traders, investors and banks have predicted that a deal will eventually be done, so a no-deal would hit the sterling. The shock referendum result on 24th of June 2016 sent the pound down 8% against the US dollar, its biggest Monday fall since the era of free-floating exchange rates began in the 1970s. That was nearly double the 4.3% drop on 16th of September 1992, when financier George Soros broke the Bank of England after his bets against the pound were instrumental in the currency's exit from the European exchange rate mechanism. Trade. Overnight, Britain would lose zero tariff and zero quota access to the European single market of 450 million consumers. Britain would default to World Trade Organization terms in its trade with the 27-state bloc, making it, in effect, as distant to its biggest trading partner as Australia. Britain would impose its new UK global tariff on European Union imports, whilst the European Union would impose its common external tariff on British imports. Non-tariff barriers could hinder trade, with prices predicted to rise for consumers and for businesses. Borders risk disruption, especially the main crossing points, with shortages of certain goods possible, as Britain imports 60% of its fresh food. Any disruption will be felt most keenly by sectors that rely on just-in-time supply chains, including autos, food and drinks. Other sectors likely to be affected will include textiles, pharmaceuticals and chemical and petroleum products. The European Union is Britain's biggest trading partner, accounting for 47% of its trade in 2019. It had a trade deficit of £79 billion, or $106 billion, with the European Union. A surplus of £18 billion in services, outweighed by a deficit of £97 billion in goods. Even with a deal, Britain's reasonable worst-case scenario is that 7,000 trucks bound for the European continent could stack up in the southern English county of Kent. The economy. Britain's Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, has forecast a no-trade deal would wipe an extra 2% off British economic output in 2021, whilst driving up inflation, driving up unemployment and public borrowing. The Office for Budget Responsibility, OBR, said tariffs under World Trade Organization rules and border disruptions would hit parts of the economy, such as the manufacturing sector, that were emerging relatively unscathed from the COVID-19 pandemic. The long-term hit could be costly for both Britain and the 27 remaining EU member states. Germany, Europe's biggest economy, is Britain's biggest EU trading partner. The shock would be felt unevenly across continental Europe, with those likely to be hit worse include Ireland, the Netherlands, Belgium, France, Luxembourg, Malta, and Poland. The Haller Institute of Economic Research has forecast that European Union companies exporting to Britain could lose more than 700,000 jobs if no trade deal is agreed. Northern Ireland. Both sides want to avoid a hard border between the United Kingdom's Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in the European Union. Implementing the Northern Ireland Protocol of the 2020 Brexit Treaty will be complicated without a trade agreement. Under the treaty, Northern Ireland remains in effect in the EU's single market for goods aligned to its customs rules after 31st of December, unlike the rest of the United Kingdom. Exactly how checks, regulations and paperwork will work between Britain and Northern Ireland is not yet clear. But without a trade deal, the divide between Britain and Northern Ireland would become more distinct. Brexit, without a trade deal, could allow Northern Ireland to become a backdoor into the EU's single market, thus raising the specter of a hard border on the island of Ireland for the first time since the 1998 peace deal. The 1998 Good Friday Agreement brought an end to 3 decades of sectarian violence between mainly Protestant Unionists, who favoured continued British rule in Northern Ireland, and the mainly Catholic Irish Nationalists, who want a united Ireland. Acrimony. Both sides would likely blame each other for any chaos after a no-deal exit, and Europe would be split just as it faces the challenges of China's rise, Russia's self-reliance, and the continuing fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic. Such a failure could shake the bloc that was created to bind the ruined nations of Europe into a global power after the Second World War. The European Union would lose one of Europe's leading military and intelligence powers, its second largest economy, and the only financial capital to rival New York. Britain would be alone, left far more dependent on its alliance with the United States. Britain is also pushing ahead with legislation known as the Internal Market Bill that would allow it to break parts of the 2020 Brexit Treaty relating to Northern Ireland, making it unclear how far it would implement the divorce deal. The City of London. London, the world's international financial capital, is largely ready for Brexit, as a trade deal was never going to cover Britain's most globally competitive industry. While most banks and investors have found ways to navigate Britain's departure from Europe, the long-term impact of an acrimonious Brexit would be unpredictable, and the European Union would likely try to grab more market share from the City of London. London is the centre of the world's $6.6 trillion a day foreign currency markets, accounting for 43% of global turnover. Its nearest European Union competitor, Paris, accounts for about 2%. The British capital is also the global centre for euro trading, a potential headache for the European Central Bank, the ECB.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Around the world with reporters.
Here in the UK, Margaret Keenan, who turns 91 next week, has received what she calls an early birthday present, the first of 800,000 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. She has been self-isolating alone since March and was pleased to get the jab.
I thought it was a joke, to tell you the truth, to start with. I couldn't believe it, you know, but I'm happy it's happened, and now I've done it, and hopefully it'll help other people come along.
At this initial phase, the elderly, vulnerable, and NHS staff have been given priority, The effects of the vaccine are expected to kick in 12 days after administration, and Margaret and everyone else receiving the jab will have another dose in 3 weeks. Full immunity can be expected a month after the first dose. In the meantime, people are being asked to stick to the rules.
My message would be, it's amazing to see the vaccine coming out. It's amazing to see this tremendous shot in the arm for the entire nation, but we can't afford to relax now.
The scientists say life might start to go back to normal by April. The British government is touting this as a success for the United Kingdom, being the first to approve a vaccine. In an interview Tuesday morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock broke down.
Just simple words there, reacting it. You're quite emotional about that.
Well, it's just, it's been such a tough year for so many people, and there's William Shakespeare putting it so simply for everybody that, you know, we can get on with our lives. And you know, there's still a few months to go. I've still got this worry that we can't blow it now, Piers. We've still got to get the vaccine to millions of people, and so we've got to keep sticking by the rules. But it's just, you know, there's so much work gone into this, and I'm really, really, it makes you proud to be British.
However, diminishing trust in the government has led to a lot of scepticism about the vaccine.
I think given the effects it's having, it's probably worth the risk. Not that I believe there is a risk, but I'd definitely be willing to take it.
Not right now. Do you know, it's too quickly, like the vaccine was made way too quickly for my own likings, and I don't think it's been tested well enough. And if it was possible to put a vaccine through this quickly, why haven't they done it before?
Because there's a pandemic going on around the world, and I don't think there's any conspiracy about it. And I've had vaccines when I was a little boy, and I'll take a vaccine now.
According to the largest survey of UK attitudes and behaviour during the pandemic, a fifth of people are likely to refuse a COVID vaccine. More than half believe that vaccines can cause unforeseen effects. And more than a third think natural immunity is better than immunity from vaccines.
Critical mass of people are going to have to get the vaccine in the coming weeks and months for it to work. The UK hasn't made it mandatory, so it might be a bit of an uphill job for the government to convince everyone that it is necessary and safe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The EU is set to decide on sanctions against Turkey over Eastern Mediterranean tensions this week. European Union final decision will take place on Thursday on the grounds of recommendations from the EU foreign ministers' meeting. The EU has been involved in Ankara-Athens tensions for a while now, since Turkey sent a search vessel to a disputed area. This comes as Turkish president is seeking to push for dialogue between conflicting parties and countries of the Mediterranean, including North and South Cyprus, assuring that Turkey is only after what belongs to it.
We are not after exploiting anyone's rights, but are only taking a firm stance against pirates that try to take our rights away. All actors will be able to find a win-win solution when everyone acts consciously with common sense and sincerity.
Turkey and Greece have been at loggerheads over the Eastern Mediterranean underwater energy resources dispute. Ankara enraged Athens by sending a research vessel to a disputed area in August, and since then, Greece has been calling EU to take actions against Turkey. However, many say it is not easy for the EU to take actions against Turkey for several reasons, including refugee deal and economic relations between Ankara and the bloc.
There is a division inside the EU when it comes to Turkey. There is an alliance led by France that is pushing for sanctions against Turkey due to latest tensions with Greece. There is another alliance on the other side led by Germany that is trying to reach consensus on a solution for the conflict. So the EU remains divided and imposing sanctions on Turkey.
Turkey says it had already shown goodwill when retrieving Uruç Reis vessel and agreeing on dialogue without preconditions. Many here believe the EU will not take serious actions against Turkey and is only after pushing Turkey to stop its activities in the region until a solution is found. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
A number of ambassadors and military attachés of different countries in Taiwan have signed a memorial book to commemorate the high status of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, the top Iranian scientist who was assassinated on November 27th. The diplomats have voiced their hatred and condemnation against this act of terror.
Right after the assassination, Russia has strongly condemned the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and believes that the main goal of such assassinations to destabilize the region and those who were behind his assassination should be severely punished.
As the ambassador of Iraq, we extend our condolences to the Iranian nation. Iraq has repeatedly seen many of such assassinations carried out by its enemies. Therefore, we fully understand the depth of the tragedy. We condemn Mohsen Fakhrizadeh's assassination and call on the international community to get united against all forms of terrorism.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the town of Absart, east of the capital Tehran. He was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but succumbed to his wounds. The scientist had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote a once peaceful nuclear energy program.
We believe that if countries remain silent towards such acts of terror and assassination, terrorists will become emboldened to continue their acts of terrorism. Therefore, ambassador and military attaché of different countries have signed a memorial book both to pay tribute to Mohsen Fakhrizadeh and condemn his assassination.
Experts believe the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt the once peaceful nuclear program.
The ambassadors and military attachés of different countries who commemorated Mohsen Fakhrizadeh strongly condemned his assassination, saying the main perpetrators should be brought to justice anytime soon. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Syria's new foreign minister, Faisal al-Miqdad, is in Iran on his first foreign trip since he was appointed. On Monday, he met his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Javad Zarif. Miqdad later met Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani, and head of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, where the two sides talked about regional issues, such as the fight against terrorism and U.S.'s destabilizing role in the Middle East.
Iran's measures to fight the terrorists in Syria have always been welcomed by the Syrian government and people. The Iran-Russia-Syria coalition to fight Daesh terrorists in Syria is a case in point, which effectively dismantled Daesh from the Arab country. Iran's time and again emphasized on a political solution to Syria's crisis, but the U.S. continues to fund and arm terrorists in Syria with the aim of toppling the government.
Syria is one of Iran's strategic regional allies. However, despite their high level of political ties, both sides agree that the level of bilateral trade between the two countries is too low. Last year, the trade volume between Iran and Syria was around $80 million. Before the Syrian conflict began in 2011, the figure stood at over $1.5 billion. This means that the conflict has been a hurdle in the way of their bilateral trade. But it's not the only problem. The existing U.S. sanctions on both countries plays a significant role.
The U.S. resorted to many ways to disrupt Iran's fight against terrorism in Syria, including the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. Washington's sanctions on Syria follow the same goal of restricting any help from Iran and Russia to the Arab country. The White House isn't willing to see that its terrorist mercenaries are defeated there.
Reconstruction of Syria has been a hot topic since the expulsion of Daesh terrorists from the Arab country. The United Nations estimates the cost of rebuilding Syria at $250 billion. Currently, Iran is active in a range of economic sectors in Syria, from transport to energy and engineering.
Faisal al-Miqdad was named Syria's new foreign minister following the recent death of his predecessor, Walid al-Muallim. The top Syrian diplomat says he will keep up his country's strategic cooperation with Tehran, especially in the fight against foreign-backed terrorists in the region. He says this is a fundamental step toward restoring peace and security in Syria and the Middle East. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
During Donald Trump's 4 years in office, relations between the European Union and the United States deteriorated so badly that the sides almost became bitter adversaries. Washington's illegal economic sanctions against Iran have prevented EU firms from doing business with the Islamic Republic. Apparently, it is an example of why the bloc needs to become more autonomous.
We don't accept this kind of extraterritoriality, but in practical terms, it has effects. Well, if we don't accept, we should be able to resist it.
Aside from the Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump has pushed back against the EU on trade, climate change, and how to handle COVID-19. Those are only a few examples. EU foreign affairs ministers have just adopted a policy document designed to repair the damage when Joe Biden enters the White House next month. The document states we need to work together to preserve the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action as endorsed by United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231-2015. But despite the EU